All right, everyone. It is 12:30. We will get started. Welcome. Welcome to this. You still have time to leave if you'd like.
Hi. I've been drinking.
So this is Home Smoky Malt for Rauch Beer. We have three panelists for you today. I am Jen Blair. I'm a member of your governing committee. So thank you. Thank you. Before we get started, you all have heard this. Join me in making sure your phones are silenced or turned off, please. They will be taking questions at the end of the session. We have the mic over here. Please ask your questions at the mic. I know we're kind of a smaller group right now, but we're recording all of the sessions. So if you use the mic, we can make sure that we can record your session to listen to later. We've got a QR code. I'm sure you've all seen this already as well. This is going to be your access to all of the archives. So as AHA members, you have access to all of our past HomebrewCon presentations. These will be available in a few weeks, but until then, you can use this QR code. It's a link that will take you directly to the archive for all of our presentations. And what else do I have here? Oh, inside of the app, there is a two-question survey. It shouldn't take you very long when this session is over. Please click on that. And make sure to leave us some feedback so we can make sure that for all of our homebrew cons, we're providing you with the kind of content that you are looking for. And with that, I'm going to introduce these gentlemen to my right. First, we have John Hall. John is the editor of Beer Edge and the host of Drink Beer, Think Beer podcast. He's the author of several books, including the forthcoming Craft Brewery Cookbook. He is also the host of BYO Magazine Nano podcast and a contributing editor at Wine Enthusiast. Next, we have Michael Burry. Mike has been an award-winning homebrewer and mead maker for over a decade. He is a BJCP Grandmaster 3 judge with mead certification and is the former president of the Stony Creek Homebrewers. As a chemist, he enjoys the complex chemistry that occurs in fermented beverages during both the production and the consumption process. Forever in pursuit of great beer and mead, he doesn't allow the trappings of particular styles to ruin his experience. In his spare time, Mike enjoys landscaping, woodworking, and most home remodeling projects. And last, certainly not least, we have John Putnam. John has been a homebrewer for over 12 years. He is a BJCP certified beer and mead judge with sensory training. He is a past president of Stony Creek Homebrewers. His preferred styles to brew are English and Irish ales, all Belgian styles, and of course, Rauch beer. John lives in southeastern Pennsylvania with a very understanding wife and two rescue Newfoundlands. So everyone, please join me in welcoming our panel.
All right. I know John's going to say something in a second. I just want to point out that, first of all, this is my first homebrew con ever. And I've been covering beer for 20 years. And the hospitality and the passion that you all have is awesome. So that's thing one. But two, there's a Facebook group and a Instagram and Twitter thing called This Week in Rauch Beer, which kind of started off as a joke that has now turned into like a very meaningful group. If you're on Facebook, go join This Week in Rauch Beer. And in thinking about HomebrewCon, I was like, oh, we should do a Rauch Beer talk because nobody's going to show up to it. So I put it out to the group, and I was like, hey, who's done some cool things with Rauch beer? And Mike and John came up, and they're like, we've done some cool things with Rauch beer. And so we sent in this proposal, and the three of us never thought that we'd be sitting up here. So this is a real treat and a failure by your governing body. So thank you for having us here, and because I know you all like stickers, there's stickers on the table in the back as well. But, John, take it away, because you're...
Well, afternoon, everybody. Prost.
Prost.
So I'm going to actually ask for showing of hands. Oh, by the way, there are jars of the malts that we smoked. Pass them around, put your nose to them, sniff them, see if you can detect something that's different. How many people, well, I know you guys are all crafty because you're homebrewers, right? How many people here smoke? And I don't mean this kind of smoke. I mean smoked meats, stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
If you're doing that other kind of smoking, it should be legal soon.
God, I miss Camelot.
All right. How many are doing it on like a ceramic griller, like a Big Green Egg, Komodo Joe kind of thing? Okay, just a few. How about Traegers or pellets? More. Great. Anybody smoking on like a Weber or a gas grill? applaud you for that one. That's not easy. All right. We kind of had this thing. So Mike is a bench chemist in pharmaceuticals, and I worked in pharmaceuticals for 30 years because, you know, everybody in Southeast Philadelphia area has something to do with drugs, no matter what. You know, and Yoon's out here in the West. You kind of believe that all the time anyway. But we decided, like, all right, let's get creative, but let's put something to an experimental basis. So we're talking about, you know, smoking meats, and we're talking about, well, what if you smoked your own grains? Because every time you go to a homebrew store, all you can find is mostly cherry, once in a while beechwood, right? Well, we thought, let's do something different. So our concept was, let's take a great malt and put it on a smoker and see if we can impart that same flavor or different flavors and what was it going to look like. So back in 2018, we actually did this experiment for our homebrew club. We actually did 10 different woods. And it was quite enlightening when we did those 10 different woods. We actually plan on doing a Smoke Chronicles 2, as we called it, where I'm going to take one style of wood and do different lengths of smoke to the point, are you getting so acrid that you can't use it? So is there an optimal time that you keep on smoking the woods? So that's something we're going to do in the future. But we took Brees, and kudos, thanks to Brees, who donated a 50-pound sack of Two Row to us for this. And we took three species of wood that you normally use in smoking. Applewood, Jack Daniel's wine barrels, and maple pecan mixture of wood. We knew it had to be repeatable. We knew we wanted to take all the variables out of it. If anybody was at Josh's session yesterday morning, focus on one thing. And the one thing that we changed was the wood. And by the way, perfect timing. Josh has an article about Rauch beer right now going out. So we did it without fluctuation and change in the recipes. I have a big green egg. Actually, I have two of them. My wife thinks I'm a little obsessed with smoking stuff. Took 5 pounds, or 7.5 pounds of Brees, and I did it in three batches, 2.5 pounds per batch, because when I spread out the malt, it was about the perfect ratio on an extra large big green egg. Didn't want to have it too thick of a bed, didn't want it to be too thin. Soaked it with distilled water. You know, you could use tap water, but then you're going to start introducing minerals and things that you may have in your tap water. So we said, what's the perfect thing? Distilled water. Completely, you know, controlled. The reason we dust it with the water and let it drain is because you want the smoke to be able to latch on something. And when you're smoking it, you also didn't want the grain to dry out overly. You start losing that, you know, the sugars you're trying to get out of it. You're just kind of baking it away. So I held the big green egg at 175 degrees. I'm like, okay, let's put in 1.5 pounds of smoke, of smoking woods, and put it onto an aluminum screen that I had on top of the grate. Let the smoke roll for 15 minutes, go and turn it over, to try and expose it, keep on doing that. So it was a very repeatable process for us. Like I said, we wet the malt for two reasons. One, you want to make sure that you're not drying it out, but giving that smoke something to really latch onto, because the hull of grain is pretty tough. So you want to be able to do that. Are you guys on your first beer or your second beer already? First. Let's get the second one out, okay? Brought it up to temperature, held it 175 degrees. I use a thing called a BBQ Guru, which has a little fan to keep your temperature constant. If you guys don't have one, you've got a smoker, it's the best thing in the world. You can sleep through the night when you're doing pork butts. Don't have to get up. So just a little bit of fun pictures there. Talk about the sequence a little bit earlier. I use an offset plate setter so you don't get a direct heat to it. You get the smoke curling around. I think the new Komodo Joes actually have this new system where it actually curls the smoke to give you more intensity of flavor. And, sorry. Closed it, did the timer, pile it up. I'd walk in. My dogs would want to attack me because I smelled like bacon. It was kind of fun. My wife's asleep on the couch because I'm doing this at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, waking her up. And she's like, you smell like you're outside smoking cigars. I'm like, well, yes, I was, but I was also smoking malt. Some things you kind of try and have to get away with.
Sure.
So did it for all three species. So you're getting the second one right now. When you're doing this, see if you perceive a difference from the first one that you had. And see if you can't start, like, coordinating it with what you smelled. So Mike is going to go into the recipe and what he went from there.
Alrighty, thanks, John. So now that I had the raw materials from, you know, Putnam, you know, Rauch, you know, Incorporated, I could actually, you know, finally LLC. I could finally actually, you know, make the beers. In a complete disclaimer, the recipe that you see on the screens isn't meant to make a world class, you know, Schlenkerla, Spetzel, Rauch beer, but rather just really kind of reinforce the smoked malt itself. So for the grist itself, I used 7 pounds of the smoked malt, with the balance being in these containers that are currently going around. That was actually 2/3 of the grist. I know, you know, some individuals think that you need to make a smoked beer with 100% of Rauch malt. Not necessarily the case. It's always about the intensity of the smoke that you have in that malt itself. I did want to have a bit of malt complexity as well, you know, so it wasn't just all about the smoked malt. And that's why you see there's a little bit of Munich, a little bit of Bark Pilsner. I prefer the Bark versus just kind of a regular Pilsner. I feel it gives you a bit more graham cracker and cereal flavors and aromas. A bit of Melnoiden because, you know, Rauch beer, you know, was a decocted lager, although you'll kind of look at the bottom of the recipe list and you'll see that this is not a lager at all. And then a little bit of Midnight Wheat just for kind of color adjustment. Hops, you know, kind of a prototypical half an ounce of Magnum for bittering, and I had a little bit of Mittelfrüh that was left over in my fridge, and I'm like, I need to get rid of it, so I chucked it in at 0 minutes. Water, I'm actually on well water. You know, it's I like brewing with it. It definitely leans more towards maltier beer styles than hoppier beer styles, which you can kind of see in a 10-to-1 chloride to sulfate ratio, which is heavily malty. So what I usually then need to do is add a bit of gypsum to kind of balance out that ratio to really bring it back into a 1-to-1 ratio at the very end. To do this, I add 2 grams of gypsum into the hot liquor tank and 1 gram into my mash tun. I did forget to add it here as well, but I added 15 milliliters of 10% phosphoric acid to bring the mash pH within a reasonable range. For me, it's usually around 5.3. And then kind of what I alluded to, that the beers that that were brewed that you're tasting now actually were fermented with USO5, American ale. So no lager strains were harmed in the production of this beer.
Thank God.
Yeah. And I, honestly, like when you know, John mentioned that I was a bench chemist as well, I'm always about reproducibility. And what I kind of have at home, to try and do 3 lagers all together, all at the same, is going to be difficult to do. Whereas I can easily just, you know, slightly overpitch a dry ale strain, have consistency. My basement actually stays around 65 degrees, so I actually cooled everything down to 62 degrees, pitched the yeast, allowed it to free rise to 65. All right, my system that I brew on, I absolutely love it. So I am the mad scientist. I do like to mingle beer styles together. For instance, I'll take the first runnings and caramelize them, similar to maybe like a Scotch ale, and then decide to make an alt beer out of them. I do kind of weird things like that. But I mainly use a ThermoWorks pH meter for doing all of my pH measurements. I find this pH meter actually very consistent. It has a small well for the probe to actually go into, and then that actually has another larger seal, and so I get very minimal evaporation of the buffering solution on the probe. And if you have minimal evaporation as well, that means less salt formation on the probe, more consistent readings over a longer period of time. And the greatest thing, it's only like $75-$80 on sale, so I always like it. And then I brew on an E-Herm system that was actually kind of developed by Cal Wellner, the electric brewery. I didn't buy it pre-made. I actually built it myself, but I want to give a ton of kudos to Cal because I had a few issues during the construction of it. He was super, super friendly. He answered all the emails and questions that I had within 24 hours. It was actually absolutely amazing. And then 100 points to anyone that can find the hidden Mickey in one of my slides. And then for all of my cooling, I actually just do an immersion chiller that's propped up on legs so it doesn't actually hang on to my my heating element that sits in the boil kettle. A typical process is really I do all of my bulk water, salt acid adjustments to begin with, so that's all nice and consistent. I do a 60-minute mash. I generally check the mash pH after about 10 minutes and also at the end of my 60-minute mash just to make sure that I'm kind of in the right range. If I'm not, I can make adjustments. That 10 minutes is really allow for the sweet wort to kind of migrate its way through through the coil, through the bed, and have a nice consistency throughout the entire mash. I do a 60-minute boil, pretty standard. Chuck in my immersion chiller and Werflock at 15 minutes left in the boil so I can sanitize it, and then easily chill. Depending on if I am fermenting in a glass carboy versus my conical, if it's glass carboy, I'm just racking it out with a racking cane. If it's in my conical, I'm pumping it out. And I think the main important thing why we use this system versus maybe your system, besides your system being, you know, stuck in the garage, you know, covered in dust and everything else. But.
I did major renovations.
Wow, mean. Accurate, but mean.
Accurate, very but mean. is really the elimination of variables. I've brewed, I think, 120 batches on the system. My mash efficiency is usually within 2% from batch to batch. And I have a lot of confidence in this system of what it can produce. And it was probably a couple of years ago when I had a group of individuals over to do a four-person group brew. And we wanted to brew basically the same beer four times. That also kind of answers the question about reproducibility. My original gravity was within one gravity point for all brews, and my mash pH was within 0.02 of each other. So pretty reproducible. And I say that because of these values that are on this next slide here. So the three beers that we have for you today are the apple, the maple pecan, which was a 50-50 blend.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Sean. As well as a Jack Daniel whiskey barrel staves. And what I found really kind of interesting, first of all, was even though, you know, John's process was really consistent between all the different batches of malt, that the actual consistency of the kernel itself changed with the different woods. So in the case of the apple, it was a little bit on the softer side. The maple pecan was actually kind of squishy and almost mealy-like. And the whiskey was actually, you know, a normal malt that you would actually just brew with. When I actually brewed all three beers, the mash pHs, even though the initial pH of my brewing water was the same, the mash pH actually changed with each wood. You can see that the maple pecan is actually the most acidic, lower in mash pH than the other three, with the whiskey actually being kind of what I would say, you know, in the sweet spot for my beer. Final runnings then also concurrently changed because I don't really adjust my sparge water. I just sparge with what do I have. So I'd also be curious to see if anyone can pick up any additional tannins or issues with the whiskey beer since my final runnings are above 6, which is usually your danger zone. Concurrently, what I found really interesting was that depending on how the kernel type was, that the original gravity, and these were all pre-boil gravity or pre-boil volumes of 7.4 gallons, but that original gravity, I think, dramatically changed between the three different woods. 2020 hindsight, I went back and I weighed out how much malt I had left over after adding 7 pounds into each batch. And what I actually found out that the leftover malt was different with each one. Through that, I was able to actually calculate the residual water after smoking the malt that occurred. And I think the interesting correlation that I found was depending on the kernel type post-smoking, that directly translated into how much residual water was left. So the most squishy mealy had the most water. So question was, just for recording purposes, was how many days post-smoking was there before I actually brewed the beers? And it was actually about, what, 3 weeks to a month? Somewhere
three
in there?
It was 3 weeks.
3 weeks. And I brewed all three beers in back-to-back-to-back days.
Did you take any special precautions to try and preserve the smoke character, freezing, vacuum sealing, anything of that?
They were vacuum sealed.
Yep. And a little actually kind of side note that John gave me the malt after our annual Founders Day picnic that we had for our homebrew club. And it was about halfway through the day. All I did was take these bags of malt. I stuck them in my car. My car then smelled like smoke for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So if you want a
that
really great car
the
air
resale
freshener,
value.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Does do it double duty, right?
Right, yeah.
Fermentation was relatively straightforward in three nearly identical glass carboys, just with typical airlocks on the top with star sand in each. Made sure I labeled each because it's pretty easy to kind of get them confused. And really, these three fermentations were, these three woods were chosen, John alluded to this, because of a previous experiment that we did with multiple wood types. We actually also had an internal standard with this previous experiment where we used cherry wood that we smoked, or you smoked, and then cherry wood that was purchased through Breeze. The beers were identical in original gravity and flavor profiles. So you can reproduce commercially made smoked malt at home.
No.
We'll be getting to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I make an observation, though, about all three before we start the reveal? Because obviously people in this room love Rauch beer, and there's a certain amount of smokiness that comes through. But these three also have a sweetness to them. And there is a almost a soda-like or cola-like or sarsaparilla ginger-like thing that I'm picking up off of individual ones as well. And I'm wondering if you both, we didn't rehearse this, so I'm wondering if either of you picked up on any of the sweetness of it.
Yes. Yes, very much so. And that's somewhat typical of the wood as well.
Mm-hmm.
People don't think of oak as being a sweet wood, but it actually is a very sweet wood. And especially when you have Jack Daniels, think about that. Whiskey is a sugar base. And part of what you're trying to extract from the oak barrels is that vanilla and that sweetness that gives bourbon that oh-so-good flavor. The one thing that I also wanted to talk about real quick is Mike talked about how the different malt were, some were a little squishier, had a little bit of moisture content. The one thing people are probably wondering is why. Smoke actually will close up the pores of the husk more so than others. And if you smoke malt or smoke meats, you'll realize that there's certain times you use a wood and you're not getting that ring that you normally would get based on the wood. The more different woods have different rings because they actually start closing up the pores. And it's all from the wood itself. It has nothing to do with the moisture content of what you started with. It's what closed up and held the moisture in versus what allowing it to dry out.
Great point.
Yep. Yeah, thank you.
And actually, to the sweetness question as well,
yeah.
The final gravity of all three beers is 10-10. So the sweetness that you're picking up is not from any residual sugar. It's
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and no caramel malt was also harmed in the making of the beers either. So.
Yeah. Any concerns with your smoking malts, any concerns about residual grease and barbecue sauce that might be in your...
No, but damn good question.
Because,
yes, and those are called leavings, and they're wonderful. But for this one, what I did is I actually did what you call a burn-off. So you take the big green egg up to about 800 degrees, which, believe it or not, you can do with charcoal. You just basically fill it up, open up the both the vents, light it, and walk away until everything is burned off. Your plate setter gets clean, your grills get clean, you scrape it down. There's nothing left. One key point I'm going to point out on that, though, it also depends on the type of hardwood you're using in your grill. So if you're using like a Cowboy Magic, don't ever use red oak, by the way. Sorry, Bill.
wow. We just lost a major sponsor.
Okay. Well, tell them to stop sending stone when you get the bag. Okay, it's a lot of stones in the bottom of the bag.
I don't know what this is.
But
so
cowboy or what they call hardwood hickory, which is actually more than just hickory, nice subtle flavor. If you want an intense flavor, which we would not use on this one, you use Jealous Devil. That's going to impart more of the hardwoods. Notes as well. So yeah, we're conscious about not having those residual barbecue kind of flavors on there.
I will say that there are microphones on either side, and I know it's difficult to rise and walk and speak, but Josh Weichert over here would really like to hear your questions, and since we're recording this. So yes, sir, with the hand raised, there's a microphone. Like, I'm doing this whole thing right now, and just...
Yeah, and no,
I, he has to.
So the right. reason I said don't use red oak is I mean we
some
joke
malicious compliance right now.
Yeah. We literally had this conversation two nights ago while we were in probably our 15th beer. Red oak, yep, four. Bring out four. Red oak, I have typically found. I used to love red oak early on. It was a really cheap bag. You get, you know, this big red bag. What's that?
Royal Oak.
I always call it red oak because it's a red bag.
Oh, okay.
When you get done, you're like, what the hell are all these rocks in the bottom of my grill?
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot of rocks, and we started finding, and I know we've talked about, the chunks of wood are getting smaller and smaller, which makes for an inefficient process. So, That's why I was saying it.
Okay.
Not from a flavor standpoint, just because it's not worth your money.
I got red oak that I use as the heat base, and then pecan that I use as a smoke base.
Yeah.
And it's worked good for me, so I was.
But you find a ton of rocks in the bottom of your grill.
I worked a deal with the local tree guy. I got two dump trucks of red oak for a case of Corona.
No, I meant Royal Oak.
Who
Royal Oak?
Who lost that bet?
Alrighty, so moving on, I guess.
This presentation was never supposed to happen.
A quick question.
Oh,
and unfortunately, I missed the do-it-yourself part.
Apparently. No, we haven't gotten
there yet.
We haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, we're running way off.
No, this is. I'm going to truncate it really fast. It's basically don't do it.
No, because I came here hoping to figure out if I can use my own woods, because we have an apple orchard.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I prune.
Yeah.
And I want to know how to prepare that and rauch my
season
own.
Your wood for a year. Just let it sit for a year before
I'll
you use it as a smoker.
Wait until the next, when we get there then.
Sounds good.
All right.
So I guess, you know, the really outcome, you know, did this actually work? So the first three beers that were presented to you, did we actually just give you the same exact beer? Or, so actually by a show of hands, who thinks all three beers are different? That's almost unanimous. So we'll get there on the next slide.
There's a microphone.
You know, and then, you know, from a judging perspective, you know, what were their differences? Were there differences in, you know, appearance of the three beers? Or were the appearances kind of, you know, relatively similar? Or were they, you know, mostly about, you know, aroma and flavor? Any mouthfeel components? You know, you can imagine, you know, smoke also being a phenol itself. Phenols can have other mouthfeel components.
Yeah.
Some drying aspects could be a bit too astringent in some and, you know, pleasantly supportive to a hot bitterness in other cases. You know, I think the question, you know, why would anyone do this in their right mind? I think it's a good one, but I think it allows you, just like in the culinary world, it allows you creativity and flexibility. You know, most of these were kind of just one single wood species, but you can start to actually play with combinations in a good way. You know, monetarily wise, was it worth it? How much did the wood cost you, John, to actually smoke?
pennies, seriously. I mean, it's if I spent $3.
Yeah, but how many?
Woods,
oh, okay.
Yeah, $3. Yeah, probably $3.
$3.
Yeah.
A sack of pale malt.
You it was free. That was even better.
Yeah. Thank you, Breeze.
Even, I mean, Two Row's pretty much, you know, Brewer's Malt Two Row, because we had that discussion, everything's Two Row. You know what is a sack cost you, what, $55, $60, although it may have gone up a little bit, you know, but it's probably the cheapest malt that you can get out there. What are you paying for smoked malt? You're paying a little bit more of a premium for that.
Yep, so absolutely.
If you got it, yeah, do it.
All right, now to kind of match the beers with the wood species.
So everybody, who thinks that number one is Jack Daniels? Oh, good. Okay, how many people think that's the maple pecan? A couple more. It's apple.
Yeah.
Okay, so process of elimination. The second one, it's got to be either the maple pecan or the Jack Daniels, right? How many people think Jack Daniels for the second one? And how many people thought maple pecan? Fairly so evenly split.
Split.
Yeah. Second one is Jack Daniels.
Third so one congratulations maple. To everyone who actually got all three correct.
And keynote, Mike talked about blending. The second one is actually a 50-50 split of maple wood and pecan wood. It's all because I ran out of maple wood.
And the other aspect, too, is what we found out in the previous trials of the multiple woods. Straight-up maple actually is quite, like, harsh and biting. It's not pleasant, really, to work with in a smoking context.
The reason we chose those three different woods, apple, everybody thinks of apple as being sweet, which it is, and it's a wonderful wood to smoke with, absolutely wonderful. That's why you have applewood smoked bacon.
Yeah.
The Jack Daniels is because we're looking for that little nuance. We also did, in our first experiment, was red wine whiskey barrel as well. And the red wine was a really neat flavor, not something I want to drink a lot of because it started getting a little bit more tannic of anything. And then we did the maple pecan because we thought the pecan would actually add some nuttiness to it as well, you know, just a little bit from that wood standpoint.
Yeah, so recommendations for everyone here of, you know, woods to use and as well as woods not to use. Really anything that you would basically consume the product of, so anything that you'd normally use for smoking meat, fish, et cetera, I definitely would recommend those. Fruit woods in particular. You know, we really love the idea of actually using barrel staves and other types of, you know, wood products that have been previously used for brewing or for winemaking. You can basically think of it as upcycling it. You know, after you've used a barrel a couple of times, you've extracted as much oak and tannin as you can out of that barrel, what are you going to do? Burn it? Well, you might as well make smoked malt out of it. It's upcycling. Some nut woods also work out pretty well. You just have to be cognizant of probably smoke duration and really kind of amount of those. You know, hickory, mesquite is going to be a little bit of a stronger smoke. So go maybe a little bit light-handed. Woods that we would not recommend, anything that has a lot of sugar content to it. It ends up producing a product that is just kind of acrid, bitter, and not at all pleasant. And please don't use anything that you would use to build a home with. So kind of goes without saying.
I mean,
but
it's pretty expensive at Home Depot these days.
That's our disclaimer, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, what is it? Yeah, I think $8 for a stud nowadays. So
yeah.
Definitely not cost effective either. And then the other thing is, cedar, Spanish mahogany, rosewood, all actually have allergy-containing compounds, and that can actually have an allergic response in people that are susceptible to those woods as well, so we would not recommend those either. This next slide is really kind of a reference for you all, as you kind of go back and look at these slides, but it's really relatively straightforward. You probably have a lot of the equipment already as part of your brewing kit, except with maybe having some type of home smoker. If you don't have one, partner up with a friend who does. You can still do it. And I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to John Hall.
Thank you so much. I do want to – so I have like a prepared part of this, but you guys are much more interesting. When you were talking about making sure that it's cured for a year, what does that impart as far as the wood go?
You get down to – and Matt, you're here. You know this. One of our members of the club also does a lot of actually fletching, milling of wood. you need to get the moisture down to a reasonable level. So by curing it for a year, you go through the season of dryness, humidity, so it stabilizes out, and it gets to what you typically will get when you're buying, you know, prepackaged smoked woods. They let that stuff cure for a year or two. Or if you're Matt, you have a kiln. Matt can have it for you ready in, like, 3 weeks. But that's... Oh, no, don't leave it outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously.
The question was, don't leave it outside.
Uncovered.
But that was
uncovered, because you leave it covered, it actually holds moisture in, and you start developing fungus and other things within the wood. It's great if you want to get spalted woods, but right, that's not what you're looking for.
And mushroom IPAs never took off.
Although I'd like to try brewing that once, just once. Truffle IPA.
All right, so here's my brief little bit on all of this. And as a journalist covering the beer industry for the last 20 or so years, I've always been struck by homebrewers leading the charge for the way that the industry goes. And one of the things that I enjoy about it is, and obviously there's a lot of insufferable homebrewers out there, and professional brewers and drinkers. But if you have the education behind it and you can put it forward in a certain manner, it brings people to a deeper understanding of beer. And Rauch beer especially is a really tough sell, because we all want to drink it in this room. The brewers want to make it and have it out there. But the people who don't know, they want nothing to do with what we're talking about in this room right now. And so I pulled from the All About Beer archives, interviews, and some conversations that I've had over the last 20 or so years to put this next part together. And I'll point out that I started my career in print, where I did not have to worry about pronunciations of things. And I say this now because there's this bit ahead where I'm going to have to say some Scandinavian words, and I'm going to butcher the shit out of them. And it's really bad. So briefly, I just sort of want to just go back to the history a little bit of how we got to where we are right now. And the modern beer renaissance has led to the rediscovery and appreciation of many traditional beer styles, as we know, and it's been followed by a wave of experimentation among the more adventurous brewers. And Rauch beer is one of the more obscure styles that's out there, and it comes in several forms. The most common that we know are the ones that are coming from Bomberg these days. And while it's certainly not us in the room, for the uninitiated, the slap of smoke and the aroma of a beer can be a little intimidating. And this is where the conversation comes in. This is where you all have to be the ambassadors of Rauch going forward. Because most people can warm up to the unique flavor of Rauch beers as their palate acclimates. More than most beer styles, smoked beers are tethered to malting history. Until just about 400 years ago, professionally turning raw barley into malt for brewing could be a clumsy process, to say the least. And most beers had a nefarious smoky character due to this manner of malt production. Farmhouse and domestic brewing, the norm through most of history, meant that each brewer was responsible for his or her own ingredients. Drying the sprouted barley was approached via various avenues. Air-dried malt may have been a feasible alternative in arid regions, but for most self-sufficient maltsters, some sort of heat was required. So most commonly, green malt was dried over open fires. And this meant, of course, that the malt would absorb much of the smoke's component in its husk and in turn would impart the smoke flavor, aroma to beer. Simply put, smoke was an expected component of beer. All beers were smoky back in the day. All beers were Rauch beers back in the day. So much of the historical notation survives about the preferred fuels for drying the malt. Wooden straw would have been commonly used early on, but wood became scarce as forests diminished across Europe. But straw survived as a clean, quickly renewable source for the kilns. Peat was used in some locales to dry barley and is still in use today, obviously with scotch. Coke, made from coal, whose impurities are volatilized during processing, made cleaner malt. No matter what fuel was used, the malt would have been smoky and dark in color, with the beer mirroring the flavor and appearance of the malt. So the changes were looming, though, as brewing technology advanced. And today's smoked beers are the rare, smoldering nod to the olden days. And perhaps nothing did more to shape modern brews than the invention of the kilns that heated malt indirectly. And I think you guys sort of talked to this a little bit about indirect heat and making sure that there is that barrier between the two. I'm curious from your perspective when you were doing it, like how you were managing that.
So in the ceramic grills, there's a thing, I think they've changed the name, but originally it was called a plate setter, and it's a ceramic insert that is a barrier between the direct heat from the coals and the actual whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
So if you're doing a pork butt or brisket or salmon or something like that on a big green egg, you don't want to or ceramic, you don't want to have that direct heat that's going to kind of sear it but not allow for that smoke to get in, especially if you're slow smoking something. I mean, I do pork butts for 18 hours on my smokers. That allows for the smoke to actually waft around and it really get, because it's still sitting on top of the grate, and that's why we had the screen, you know, it was like a mini grate, so that you're getting both sides or you're really getting it treated with smoke but without as much of the heat. It's an indirect heat. So it's kind of like the difference between doing an open flame of, you know, cooking off some like peppers versus putting them in the oven, which is more of an indirect heat.
Yeah.
So that's why, because otherwise you're gonna fry the husk and close it up, and you're never gonna get really any smoke flavor out of it. So it's kind of why you have to think about it from that standpoint.
Yeah. What is the city most commonly known with smoke beer? Thank you very much. It's situated obviously in the northern part of Bavaria. It's known as Franconia. It's historically important as a former outpost of the Roman Empire and obviously home to a number of celebrated breweries. It's also still a malting center. The agricultural center is still very traditional, and that's why the brewers, I think, have probably held on to their traditions. So the breweries in and around Bamberg brew a wide range of German-style beers, Bock, Pilsners, Helles, Dunkels, and even Weiss beers, and many of them will be making their beers with a significant or at least a modest portion of Rauch malt. Of the two breweries in Bamberg, obviously Schlenkele is the more intrepid because they're known a little bit wider. But Brewery Speciel, founded in 1536, is the oldest of the Rauch beer breweries these days. And though they make Rauch beer in the Märzen style, it's a seasonal, their signature Rauch beer is more in keeping with the Vienna style. And if you've had it, there's a soft maltiness, relatively mellow smoke character. It's only about 40% Rauch malt in there. The rest is about normal tradition Bavarian Pilsner malt, and the ABV is usually around 5% or so. When you think about the 1500s, though, it's kind of fun because... Let's talk about the DIY portion at this point. Because we think about going back to Bavarian breweries, back to the 1500s, and we can be awestruck by history, and we can be awestruck by the traditional. And then the descendants of Vikings in Norway show up, and they say, hold my Rauch beer. So, Jørn Geving... he reached out recently on the This Week in Rauch Beer Facebook page with a brief masterclass on how to build and this is where I'm going to butcher it, but I believe it's Seenhaus. Does anybody want to correct me on that? Right. Where are my Norwegians at? Cool. So I have the mic, and I'm just going to say that that's what it is. So he knows a few things about this, though. He's an avid maltster in his town, and he has been smoking his own malt for more than 30 years. We tried to get him here, and he just could not be here. The tradition in Norway, right, we're talking about Bavarian, breweries going back to the 1500s. That's really cute. The tradition in Norway can be traced back to 1050. And they have found in archaeological sites old Saxon houses that have been processing malt. Take that, Germany. He says that today Norway has about 40 active Norwegian smokehouses that make about 20 tons of malt every year. And most of the houses are small and simple and carefully managed due to fire risks. Still, there are temporary options that can be built, and the photos here that we're going to talk about are from one that he built recently in his town square. And it's built the same way that maltsters build new smokehouses today. So the only difference is that this is a smaller version and can be constructed and then picked up again for later use. So a little description. Here we go. A little description on how you can make your own Norwegian smoke malt house and make what he calls, what Jorn calls, the world's best smoked malt. And in all of my conversations with folks along the way, I have to stress this the most. There are fire risks with this. Like, if you have a Big Green Egg, if you have a Traeger, you're not going to worry. John's not worrying about his house burning down over the course of 18 hours because the lawyers have gone through that equipment. If you guys are working with cinder blocks and sand and wood and open flames, there is a fire risk. And I just want this on tape right now. Sobriety and vigilance are your best friends during this process, okay? So the smokehouse itself
In other words, don't do it.
Yeah, no, seriously. This was never supposed to be a presentation. You all think I'm joking. All right, so essentially it's cinder blocks that you can get. And then you can fill them, if you want it more permanently, with liquid concrete, or you can put glass insulation in there. You can put some stone wool between the blocks. Or you can also fill them with sand. Oh, look, there's a shameless plug for This Week in Rock Beer. That's cool. So in the fireplace itself, they have laid concrete slabs to protect the surface underneath from the heat of the fireplace. And over the fireplace, they then put a slate slab. But then you can also use a metal plate. Are we missing slides? Did I? Oh, okay.
What's the blue stuff at the bottom?
That is how they are protecting it. That's like they put some foam down, and then they put some more stone on top of it to basically prevent the stone from cracking. And then
and it doesn't melt.
It did not melt in this process. Yeah. Results may vary. I feel like I need legal right now. This is making me very new. So, all right. So over the fireplace, though, they put a slate slab, but you can also use a metal plate. This plate is used to dissipate the heat. This is what John was talking about before, and prevent the flames from going straight up into the malt floor and burning the malt. The key here is airflow. You do not want to burn anything. You don't want any of the sparks touching any of the malt, and the whole thing is about designing airflow to get through. Right? Do you want to?
Absolutely. Yeah. So actually, when I was smoking, there's like three areas that are open to allow the smoke to come up. And if I had grains on that edge, great caramelization. But some of them you're like, yeah, that's not going in there because it actually burns it off. So you want to be careful because once you get, I don't know if you've ever seen grain can start to burn pretty quick.
Yeah.
And it does not smell as good afterwards or taste as good.
Yeah. No. It's fine on wood-fired pizzas, but in very small amounts. So the house is a little bit over 3 feet high. You can make it higher, but not lower, because then it'll be too hot and the malt will be easily burned or scorched. The malt frame itself is 1.5 by 8 inches and 2 by 6. And the malt frame, and I'll give you all of this afterwards, I promise. But the malt frame itself is 1.5 by 8 inches and 2 by 6 as well. And then the malt floor, which is a spruce panel, is about 1 square meter, about 15 millimeters. It's important, Jorn says, to use spruce because pine will add an unwanted taste to the malt. Oh, you're not. You want to jump in on this?
Yeah, avoid softwoods. It's really what it comes down to. Because everybody knows you never put pine in your fireplace. What's going to do? Creosote. Burn right up.
And if you see that top frame as well, where they have the where the malt goes in as well, it's just as simple as then drilling holes in to create the airflow. You want them about 6 millimeters in size, and then you want about 1,500 to 2,000 of them.
So don't do it. We got 10 minutes.
How long does that take to actually draw those holes?
Again, this was never supposed to be a presentation.
Buy a big green egg.
Yeah. it is an advantage if the panel has tongue and groove because it'll shrink at least 4 centimeters when you start firing. The malting process is pretty typical here. Steep it, germinate it, then dry it in the house. As seen here, remove the rootlets afterwards. You can use any kind of malt, although you ran a little bit of – you had some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, just use base 2-row unless you want to do something that you want to have a little bit. Like, yeah, could you smoke chocolate malt? Why not? Go for it.
Alderwood is good for the fire, if that's what you want to do. But obviously take a page out of what these gents have done.
Actually, we did alder in our first time that we did this, and it was well-received. Alder is typically used for a lot of seafood fish. It's a milder. So if you don't want something that's more smoky in your face, alder's more subtle.
Typically, these smokehouses have about 50 kilograms, a capacity of about 50 kg. They'll give about 40 kg when all is said and done in here. And the drying time on this particular model that Jorn sent over was about 14 hours, but it'll vary greatly with humidity, temperature, and weather. And he also suggests flipping or redistributing about halfway through. And did you find that as well? Was that
Yeah, I was just because of the, I guess, the concentration of Big Green Egg, I was doing it every 15 minutes.
For those of you who are taking notes, the exterior dimensions are 175 by 125 centimeters, and the malt floor is about 135 by 85. 175 by 125, and then 135 by 85. Bingo! As with a Philly-built house, it is also important to have a tent or some kind of sheltering. And I was thinking about this when you think about the old German beer gardens and the steins that used to have the lids on them, that was by design to keep stuff from falling into it, like bird shit. So... it's also important if you're out in the wild to have a Coleman tent or something over it. But also then you get to stand in it, and it's just like a Rauchbier sauna, and it's kind of nice. I'm also going to point you to BYO.com. They are pretty awesome. And obviously, if you're a home brewer, you know them. But there is a great trove of information there. And if you go to BYO.com/beer/smoked-beer, beer-style/smoke-beer. You can see articles and recipes from the BYO archives. Is Malcolm here?
Yeah.
Hey, Malcolm. Hey, that's Malcolm Frazier, ladies and gentlemen. Malcolm Frazier made beer 4. Malcolm Frazier made beer number 4 that we're having, and I know we're down to like 2 minutes.
Five minutes.
All right. Malcolm, you want to tell us a little bit about this beer?
Yeah, sure. Am I loud enough?
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, but we got a thing here.
We got a thing?
We got a thing going on.
Hello.
Hey.
So
somebody's been drinking.
That's a Grogitzky or Grotzer, right, depending on what time of a year or who's occupying which country. So it normally a Grogitzky is what? 100% oak-smoked wheat malt, right? We use the local maltster CNC, and I've already bought some Vireman, and I've used Vireman smoked malt before, and I'm sitting here smelling it, and it was nowhere near as intense as the stuff from CNC that was smoked like yesterday. So that ended up being 30%. We kind of did a, this smells about 2 or 3 times more strong. Okay, so we get kind of guessed a little bit. It is 50% wheat, and then the rest is Pilsner malt. We didn't have a Polish strain of yeast, and I couldn't get some. This was kind of thrown together. I was told they were doing this. A mutual friend said, hey, Malcolm brews at Hop Farm. Maybe he'll do a smoke beer for you. And we had like 2.5 weeks to go. So
again, none of this was planned.
In fact, me coming up here was decided like yesterday.
Yeah, so. I texted him. I was like, are you in the room? He's like, no, but I can be there in 10 minutes. Literally, that's what I was doing while John was giving his presentation.
Right on. So we ended up using a hybrid ale strain, like a Kolsch strain, because it was a, you know, a facsimile, approximation of what we could have used.
Can I ask you real quick, because we only have like a minute, and I know there's probably a lot of very important questions that people want to get to. When you're buying smoked malt commercially, though, what are one or two tips that people should be looking for in what they're going to get back?
So
if you don't want to do
so
this
both.
Yourself.
I would say if you're doing commercially, or you're smoking yourself, or you're buying from a local maltster, right, if you're trying to support local, is consider the intensity. So maybe buy a known quantity, like Vireman, you can get in a lot of homebrew stores. And what I would do is I would smell them and taste them, right? And it's fun to do with friends, get their opinions, get their input. And then you can kind of go, oh, this is going to be like an ashtray, right? I judged smoke beers yesterday, which is completely coincidental. I was supposed to do American Pale Ale. And Bruce comes over and
but
goes,
nobody
hey.
Wants Pale Ale anymore.
Right. So I usually say no thank you to smoke, no thank you to barrel, no thank you to spice because it blows your palate out for the rest of the day. Bruce, he's like, hey, I need your help. And I was like, yeah, I usually tell you I'm flexible. I look over, my good friend Keith Cost is the lone judge. And I'm like, all right, we can cause some trouble. Let's go judge smoke beers.
Let's go break some hearts.
Yeah, so let's crush souls here. There was some very good beers. Like there was a Lichtenhainer that smelled and tasted wonderful. It was like ham water, which sounds weird, but... have you ever had ham water? Yeah. Not horrible.
Who submitted their Lichtenhainer yesterday?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where it went from after me. I probably should be talking. But but it was delicious and nutritious. And we had some that just were so over-the-top smoky, acrid, you know, creosote. You know, so that was yours. I'm sorry. Talk to me later.
Yeah.
3 minutes. All right. So what I would do is I would taste and evaluate versus known quantity. If you've made with a beer with Vireman before, Vireman Oak Smoke or Beechwood, taste the one you're going to use, the local maltster or the home brewed one, and make an adjustment. That's my tip. And also, stay away from softwood. Stay away from overly wetting your malt because it tastes very ashy, very creosote-like.
We're going to do the questions. I just want to point out, go to Hop Farm. They have 3 Rauch beers on tap right now.
That's irresponsible. That's an irresponsible amount.
This is a company
beer.
That does not want to make money.
Yeah.
Prove them wrong.
Yeah. Awesome.
Hello.
Questions. Yeah.
Hi. I actually, in 2020, when everything broke, closed down through COVID, saw the Norsk Cornell Festival online by Lars Marius Garsol, and Jorund was in there as well.
Yeah.
And I transcribed everything and have it on my website on medievalmeatandbeer.blogspot.com.
Wonderful.
If you want to see the original How to Malt, it's right there. It's on YouTube. You can follow him right along. The only thing I don't have is the how to build one.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for doing so.
Joran is there to help with that, and he would have been much better sitting in this seat than I was. Today,
I would have been fangirling all over him if I had known he'd be here.
Other questions? Oh, all right. We got a lineup, yeah.
How deep of a grain bed did you use for your smoking?
How thick?
Yeah.
It was probably anywhere from 3/4 inch to 1/2 inch. I try to keep it nice and consistent and thin.
Cool. And was like the tray perforated or?
It was literally from, I went to Lowe's and bought screen door replacement, aluminum screening. Yeah, I was just trying to find a small perforated structure, and that was the simplest that I thought about. And the heat was only 175, so you didn't have to worry about melt or anything else. And if you can find stainless steel, all the better. Why would you? But
thanks.
Yeah.
Hi. So you had mentioned that you were operating at 175. How critical is the temperature? So if, like, my Oklahoma Joe, I typically run at about 200, 210 versus like the old hillbilly smokehouses that you can run cold smoke at 80 degrees?
Yeah, it's what I have found. I didn't want to go higher than that because you're going to actually dry the malt quicker than you're going to get any smoke aroma in there. With a Big Green Egg, it's kind of hard to keep it below 150. You start getting a lot of fluctuation. I was looking for a sweet spot of not getting any fluctuation whatsoever. So that's why I honed in on 175. So I had done some experiments before we even had done our first round of doing this. And I had smoked cheeses at that level. So, yeah, cold smoke is ultimately the greatest way to go. But then you're talking a lot more contraction. I was trying to make something that was simple, achievable, and DIY.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, last question. And then we have to leave because Randy Mosher has his hair care seminar coming up. And he gets really mad if I'm on his stage when he shows up.
Hey, how much time between your smoke day and your brew day? And do you notice a lot of degradation the longer it goes between smoke day and brew day?
Oh, what was it? It was 3 weeks and... No, because he dropped off the malt. I actually picked up the malt, what was it, 3 or 4 days ago, and we had done this a couple months ago, and it still smells like a smokehouse. I mean, and there's probably like maybe a pound or half a pound left in the bag, and I was like, my dogs came running again. They're like, oh, you got the malt back. Okay, great. It's just kind of wild because I did not detect any drop-off in the smoke aroma coming off the malt. You're smelling them right now, and this is 2.5 months old. And, you know, as long as you keep it stored, it's going to last, you know, a decent amount of time.
Awesome. Hey, thanks, everybody.
Yeah, you too,
thanks,
John.
Thanks, you guys. And this was – and Malcolm. Yeah. Thanks, pal. And join us on This Week in Rauch Beer on Facebook, and let's have some fun, smoky conversations. Stickers in the back. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks to the servers as well.
Absolutely. Very little. Very, very little.
We literally just met each other yesterday.
Yeah. This is essentially the hazy IPA of seminars. There's no thought whatsoever.
Holy crap. I don't take these things seriously.
Dude, that was awesome.